The following message is a teaching by Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. More information about Jason can be found at deroshi-meyer.org.
Old Testament foundation, New Testament fulfillment, walking through the story of God's glory. Okay, you can see we've got four stages that we're going to walk through. Paradise is the tree of life. They can eat from it, but don't touch the tree of the knowledge pertaining to good and evil. Don't eat of it. Adam and Eve turn, they sin, and they get exiled. But before they even get exiled, hope is declared. We're going to focus on that hope. And then two lines of descent flow out of the garden. The offspring of the serpent that is characterized by God hostility, trying to destroy God's kingdom purposes, that's the majority of the world, and the majority ends up getting buried in the flood. But then there's a small remnant line who, from the days of Seth forward, are calling upon the name of the Lord. We see their genealogy in chapters 5 and chapter 11. Those who are walking with God, those who are blameless and righteous, from Adam to Noah, and from Shem to Terah, the father of Abraham. So for every one of these letters, I have tried to find a key verse, and that's what's found at the top of your handouts. The key verse that if you, say, just wanted to take 7 family worship times and just cover all that we're going to do in these multiple hours, and you've got 10 minutes to walk through it with your kids. I've boiled it down. You could teach KINGDOM with just the passages that I've provided. I think they're foundational at each stage in trying to put everything together. So here's the first one, Genesis 1, 27 and 28. And we're going to focus in on this substantially, and depending on how my time is going, I will have to... I'm going to rely on these verses because I have lots and lots of slides, and we'll see if I don't get through everything, I can at least get the gist of it by focusing on the verse. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Images of God. That's what we were called to be. To display the greatness of God. This is a world about God, not about us. We are called images of God. The heart of that is on the God part. Images point to what they represent. We are reflectors, resemblers, and representers of another. Images of God. God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. At the very beginning, God sets up one man and one woman. He brings them together in order that they together might multiply kingdom families that are surrendered to the sovereignty of God over all things, and that they might fill the earth, multiply and subdue it. That is, right now, I'm going to dwell with you in the Garden of Eden. This will be like a little temple, a sanctuary. You will, like priests, display my holiness. You'll be the instrument through which I will magnify myself. But I don't want you to stay here. I want the Garden of Eden to be ever expanding. I want what's going on here, you and us in relationship, to fill the earth. That the boundaries of the garden would be ever, ever expanding. That's the image that we have from the beginning. And as mankind would fill the earth, what's going to happen? The image of God is going to be displayed on a global scale. And what happens by the time we get to Revelation? That garden has filled the earth, and we are radiating the glory of the sun. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. We start out with God. In the beginning, God. Nothing else but Him. And then He creates. That pushes aside all pantheism. That God is in everything and everything is God. No, there's God and then there's His world. It pushes aside all naturalism because there's God. It's not just nature. It pushes aside all dualism. We'll see why in a second. Yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. Why does He deserve all this? Why is to Him the highest and the best? Because all that is in the heavens and in the earth is yours. That's our God. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and You are exalted as head above all. Worthy are You, O Lord, and God, to receive glory and honor and power. Why? That little word for, so important. You're worthy because by Your will, everything was made, everything exists and was created. Because of that, He deserves all worship. That's our God. I'm very confident you can't read that slide. But what it is Genesis 1:1 through 2:3. Now, when you look up there, you'll see there are some orange words. Those orange words are God. There are 35 of them in Genesis 1:1 through 2:3, a multiple of 7, in order to magnify His perfection. 35 times God's name is mentioned. Now, what's so distinct about this is that it doesn't happen in any other chapter of the Bible. Jason came up to the stage, he got behind the pulpit, and he began to talk. 3 sentences, but I only use an explicit subject 1 time. Jason walked up to the stage. He walked behind the pulpit. He began to talk. We don't need to repeat Jason because no other players are on the scene, and you know that I'm the subject of every sentence. But in Genesis 1, Moses goes out of his way to use God as an explicit subject whenever he can. So let me just help us feel this a little bit. Genesis 1, this is what we have. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day. God said, let there be an expanse. God made the expanse. God called the expanse. God said, God called, God said, God saw, God said, God made, God set. God, 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 God. You begin to feel something like when I see the stars, God. That's what I'm supposed to think of. When I taste the watermelon, I'm supposed to think about God. When I see that moose come out of the woods while I'm sitting in my canoe, I'm not just supposed to delight in the beauty and delight in the moose, but somehow it's supposed to raise up 1 octave to the point of praise because this is a world about God. It's a world about God. Everything that we see and smell and taste and hear is from Him and through Him and to Him. For by Jesus all things exist in heaven and on earth, things visible and invisible, thrones and dominions and rulers and authorities created through Him and for Him. Right from the get-go, Genesis 1 is screaming to a people, think about Israel, they're in the wilderness for 40 years when Moses is most likely writing this down. There were no eyewitnesses. No one was there to see this. So God revealed Genesis 1 to Moses. He told him what happened. And these people are a people who have had a very little view of God. They're in the wilderness for 40 years, dying. They're a walking mortuary, dying at a higher rate than expected. Oh, I wonder if God's going to lead us to where my brother's buried. Yeah, he was part of the rebel. My mom and dad are buried over the next hill. They were part of the rebellion. My grandparents didn't believe. They were part of the rebellion. When we open our Bibles, far too often, all we're thinking about in Genesis 1 is about history and about chronology, about how it relates to science. When Moses and his audience read Genesis 1, they were thinking about life and death and what does it mean for me to live and not die? And this text is screaming, God, get me in the center of your worldview. Let me be at the center of your universe. This is a world about God. Now you and I approach this text and we come in and we're like, I want to read about me. Okay, day one, there is light. Day two, he separates the sky and the water that he'll call the sea. Day three, oh, land appears and now vegetation. Okay, day four, the light is matched by those who would oversee the light, the sun, moon, and stars. Then the sky and the waters are filled up with the birds and the sea creatures. And now, oh, finally, day six. But as soon as we find ourselves, God won't let us stay there. Because what does it say? Let us make man in our image. So God made man in his image. We find ourselves, but as soon as we see ourselves, the spotlight is turned off of us and we recognize we are here to display him. We're like magnifiers. Microscopes magnify things that are very small. We're not that kind of a magnifier. We're more like a telescope. A telescope that sets its eye on a distant moon that is bigger and more glorious than we can see with our naked eye. And as people look at us, we're to be telescopes displaying more of the majesty and wonder and awesomeness of our God. We are images of God. And he wants that image to be taken to the ends of the earth. That's where our Bibles begin. Fall, exile, guilt. Having such an opportunity to relate with God, Adam and Eve took a right that was not theirs. I'm going to decide what is good. I'm going to decide what is evil, rather than be submitted to your definition. And God had said, if that happens, you will die. By one man's disobedience, many were made sinners. Notice the different wording between Romans 5:19 and Romans 3:23. For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. In Adam, everyone is made a sinner. That's how we are conceived before we do anything good or bad. And then we become sinners who sin. But in Adam, in this mysterious connection that we have with him as our representative, when he fell, everyone fell. There's no one born without a problem. That problem is I'm separated from God. I'm outside the garden when I am born. His presence is somewhere other than where I am. And the only way to get back into that presence is for somehow for his wrath to be appeased, because he is justly angry. Sin is serious because everything is about God. Even my oatmeal, my orange juice, whatever you do, whether you eat or whether you drink, it's supposed to be about his glory. So people look at themselves and say, well, I'm not that bad. Have you thought about God? Are you breathing and thinking, recognizing that right now, moment by moment, he is speaking, and because he's speaking, you are living? Everything upheld by the word of his power, Hebrews 1:3. And if he stops speaking, we will not exist. Yet we live as if we're autonomous, as if I don't have responsibility. And yet we do. We are dependent, and he is worthy. And Adam and Eve turned aside from that. Here's the state we find ourselves in when we are born. You were dead in your trespasses and sins. Dead people can't talk. Dead people can't walk. Lazarus was dead and in the tomb, and there was nothing that could bring him out until the voice spoke. The one who said, "Let light shine into darkness," shone in and said, "Lazarus, come forth." And now he moved. We were dead, but God. We were dead in our trespasses and sins, in which you once walked, and were by nature children of wrath. That's where we all are, separated because of our connection with Adam. Right here in these early chapters of Genesis, the entire problem of the world is being set up. But what's amazing is that these early chapters were given to a bunch of sinners. As if, rather than wiping us out, he gives hope. He actually gives us a Bible. We're sinners separated from him, and he discloses himself and his will in a way that we can understand. He's calling us to himself, and as we're going to see, he sets something up. Adam and Eve botched things up. And before God even judges Adam and Eve, that comes in chapter 3, verse 16. But in Genesis 3, 15, God declares hope. People have called it the first gospel. See if you can hear it. Satan, devil, the one that I'm declaring will be on your belly eating dust, I will put enmity between you and between the woman, between your offspring and between her offspring. Offspring is a word that is a little tricky. I can go out and target a deer, or I can go out and see many deer. That word deer is always singular. We don't say deers. Offspring is the same way. Seed. I can have a handful of seed, or I can have a single seed. So we have to ask, is the offspring of the woman singular or plural? And Moses tells us, he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. In Genesis 17:9, Moses uses offspring language, but he adds the plural pronoun, their, which says that when he's writing his story, a true story, when he's telling us the story of what happened, he can identify the offspring as singular or plural when he wants to. And here he says he. This becomes hopeful. Eve is called the mother of all the living. Why does Adam name her this? Because God had said, when you eat of the tree of the knowledge pertaining to good and evil, you will die. And yet it's because of this promise, I believe, that Eve is called the mother of the living. Cain is born. Oh, the Lord has given me a man child. Why does she say that? With the help of God. But then he grows up and he shows that he is not an offspring of Eve. He's of the offspring of the devil. His murderous activity identifies him with the serpent-like qualities of the garden. And so at the end of chapter 4 in verse 25, Eve again knows her husband. And then she says, oh, God has given me another seed to replace Abel because Cain killed him. Why did she need another seed? because Abel had been her seed, but not Cain. She's hoping in the offspring promise that God would raise up a man who would be a deliverer and crush all the powers of Satan. And in doing so, it's the hope of the world that all of this evil, this separation from God, this being separated from his presence, that there would be one day who would rise and fix all of our problems. The creation was subjected to futility. Not willingly. Did Satan subject the creation to futility? I don't think so. Not in this context. Well, it must have been Adam. No. Here's why. The creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Satan doesn't subject to futility in hope. Adam didn't do something in hope. The only hope comes from God. So this is, I think, talking about the curse that God brings on the world, but he brings the curse knowing that he has intended to overcome the curse with great blessing and to do so through the offspring of the woman. And when that offspring comes, God will get great glory. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land. Two different family trees spring out of the garden. The majority rebel, and then the small remnant. Genesis is dominated by these are the generations of 10 times. Seven of those generation statements. Five of them are stories, and they're all focused on the good guys. Two of them are genealogies, and they're focused on the good guys. Then there's three of them that are focused all on the bad guys, and they're all genealogies. Bad guys meaning that they're the rejected folk who are following the prince of this world rather than God. And the majority group ends up filling the earth with wickedness, and so God decides to bring the flood, but he will not destroy everyone. I'm sorry that I've made mankind, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. That word for favor is the word grace. That's what Noah got. He got grace. So was Noah better than all the rest? Notice this after the flood. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma from Noah's burnt offering, burnt offering was the only offering for sin before the tabernacle. And God smells the aroma of that sin offering, the substitute burning rather than the sinner. And he responds, I will never again curse the ground because of man. For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. How many men are alive at this time? There's Noah, his three sons, and their wives. And he uses a phrase that is identical to the phrase in chapter 6, verse 5. It's worded the same way. The very heart that brought about the flood is still operative in mankind after the flood. Then look what it says. I will never again curse the ground because the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. How does that logic work? I will never again curse you because you deserve a curse. That, when I look at that, it just makes me scratch my head. And then I say, oh, if God doesn't make this kind of a promise, Jesus will never get to come. Because everyone is so wicked and I've got bigger plans for the world, if I don't make a covenant with creation and put my rainbow in the sky and point my arrow upward rather than downward, if I don't do this, there's no hope for anyone. But I will do it. Because mankind's heart is evil from his youth, I'm going to enter in and declare common grace on the world. I'm going to bring rain on the evil and on the good, in order that one day Jesus might come, the offspring that was promised. I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by water. Three boys spread out, arrive at Babel. They build a tower. It's a little ironic. They want to build a name for themselves, get as high as they can, right? And then the text tells us God came down. They never reached heaven, but pride was so operative. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the tower, which the children of man had built, and the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of the earth. Pride. It cost Adam and Eve the garden, thinking that they could live their way. And it only continued. It continued all the way up to the flood, and then it continued up to the Garden of Eden. Up to the Tower of Babel. Pride. But it's into this world that God, rather than bringing another global flood, is going to raise up a man. His name is Abram. Abraham. So we started in a garden. A garden that symbolizes life, that was all about enjoying fellowship with our Creator, having a relationship with God, a personal relationship. Adam and Eve rejected the relationship. That's what we do when we sin. God was saying, let's walk this way, and they turned and said, I'm going to go my own way. And it brought judgment. The judgment was exile from the Garden of Eden and from the presence of God. But there is the promise of offspring. Those hoping in the offspring promise were a small group. It dwindled all the way down to Noah and his family. Out of all the world, only Noah and his family are saved. But it wasn't because they were great in and of themselves. No, Noah found grace. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in all of his ways. Noah walked with God. Chapter 6, verse 9 only comes after chapter 6, verse 8. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a righteous man. Where did his righteousness come from? How did he gain the power to walk with God? How could he be understood to be blameless? Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Okay. Kickoff and rebellion.
Thank you for listening to this message from the ministry of Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content in any way without written permission from Jason DeRoshi. For more information on Bethlehem College and Seminary, we invite you to visit online at bcsmn.org. For more information on Dr. DeRoshi, visit online at deroshi-meyer.org. Proclaiming the kingdom and treasuring a God who rules, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.